Hello, everybody, and welcome to Defending Peer-to-Peer Litigation. My name's Andrew Norton. I'm the researcher and general dog's body for torrentfreak.com. I'm also been heavily involved with the pirate parties around the world. My co-panelist is not here yet. He'll be here in a few minutes, hopefully. And Blair's an attorney who's defended a few litigation suits, including the some of the film ones, the mass John Doe suits. So, as a bit of a warm-up, first of all, until Blair gets here, how many people, I'm not taking any picture or anything, how many people torrent? How many people use peer-to-peer before torrent? Okay. How many people have had a letter or a notice sent through your ISP? Oh, more than I thought. How many have actually had any kind of lawsuit named at them? Or any kind of official sounding letter from a law firm? No one? Those are the odds. It's a very much, it's a percentage game a lot of the time. It's, emails are easy to send out, notices are easy to send out, they're automated systems. Letters, they got to file it, it's a long, complicated process. My expertise is how systems are, how the detections are done, the methods that can be used to prevent it and not. Blair will give you some coverage of the legal side of things that I can't because I'm not a lawyer. So don't take anything I say as legal advice, but more technical advice and hints on what to do. As a bit more of a background, in the late 90s, I worked as a copyright enforcer for a record company in the UK. I then realized the error of my ways. No, it was a family record company. But, I've been involved in following copyright systems pretty much since then, and I've been working with torrentfreak.com since 2007. So, we covered all the stories. Things like the Comcast thing, I was the lead researcher for Torrent Freak on that, with the throttling and the Sandvine deep packet inspection stuff. So, although I'm not a coder, it does surprise people, I don't do code. Never have, never really will. Can't stand it. My background's actually robotics. Most of the robotics track know me because I used to do battle bots with them. I used to be their safety and technical guy. So I have a bit of a TV experience as well. So I'm one of those that they don't like to hear about because I'm involved in the media. I'm a producer. I work at the Pirate Party, and we released a book earlier this year. I don't know if anybody has heard of it, No Safe Harbor. You can download a free copy at nosafeharbor.com. And pretty much every DRM free format I can think of when I made it. It includes things like the Declaration of Human Rights by the UN, the EFF's notes on the Fourth Amendment. If anybody was here for the 10 rules for dealing with the police last night, it's helpful there for dealing with searches. And also essays on privacy and technology. So as I say, I'm just filling in a little time until Blair gets here, because he has some more points planned. But our aim is, how do you defend against it, and what are the, you know, the methods used? So, I keep seeing that door open, and I'm hoping, is that Blair coming in? And it's not this time. But how frequently do people out here think detection goes on? Yeah, you have to really shout it out, and I'll repeat it for the audio being recorded for now. How often do you think? Yeah, how often do you think a BitTorrent swarm is being monitored? Well, it's less than roughly, I think it's about 0.1% of all BitTorrent streams are actually monitored. Yeah, exactly. There are too many torrents out there. There are too many streams. One of the most, one of the biggest preconceptions as well is things like, have you all heard of private torrent sites? Private sites like, well, Demonoid was a semi-private one. Then you have Elite Torrents. The thing about those is, the name private is misleading. The better name for it is activity logging site. It's private only in that only a certain number of people can get there, but you give so much more information to them, and they store it. So that's why pretty much every conviction over the last 7 years for BitTorrent-related things has happened with a private site. You've had Elite Torrents when they leaked the Star Wars Episode 3. People went to jail for that. The site was taken down within 24 hours of the torrent hitting on there. There are people monitoring every single private tracker site. Don't think that the admins will tell you that they're not. They are. On the other hand, you've got the public sites like the Pirate Bay. How many people use the Pirate Bay? Quick raise voice. Most of you. The Pirate Bay does not use a tracker these days. Now, we've all heard about the case. What the case was against four people involved in the case, in the site, in the past. What it was not a case about the site itself. The legality of the Pirate Bay site has never been tried in court. It's a point that's often lost. So the legalities are uncertain in that aspect, and I'm straying into areas where Blair is supposed to help fill in there, but I was like, where is he? Come on. Is that him? But when it comes to detecting and as I say, prosecuting, no, that's not him either. But when it comes to detecting and prosecuting things, it is it's actually a lot harder than it's made out. And one of the things Blair will help explain is that pretty much in any case where it's gone to court, it generally does not fall the way of the enforcers. I can speak from the UK cases. Has anybody here heard of ACS Law or Davenport Lions? 2, 3, 4 people. For those that don't, then the majority of you, they were two law firms that were in the UK, and they started off with a game called Dream Pinball. And in 2007, maybe 2008, they started sending out demand letters. We've detected you've downloaded Dream Pinball. We're going to sue you unless you pay us £500. That's about $800. And it first of all started with a law firm called Davenport Lyons. And the law in the UK is a bit different to the US. Let's get that clear for a start. In the UK, you can go and they could get the IP addresses from the monitoring company. Another misconception, the MPAA is not monitoring you. Your ISP is not monitoring you. You go to all these forums and stuff where it says, I got this letter from Comcast that says they're monitoring me. What can I do and how can I stop them from monitoring me? They're not. It's illegal. That's wiretapping. What it is it's a company who is monitoring the specific torrent and they've spotted your IP. And then they've passed it on to the copyright owner and so on. But in the UK they have a thing called a Norwich Farmacle Order, which is an order where they can go to an administrative judge, a chancery judge, and the guy's name in question was Chief Master Weingarten. His name's not a judge, that's his title, Chief Master. And he just signs an order saying, okay, yes, you get this information. And you can't contest it. Your ISP could contest it, but you can't. So they'd get these IP addresses, and then they'd send it to get your name and address from the ISP. And they'd say, they'd say, send out this letter, give us the money. And if you say no, they'll put your letter to one side and say, we want £500 because we think you've downloaded Dream Pinball. Give us the money. You send a letter back saying, no. Hooray, Blair's here. Everybody, cheer for Blair. I'm giving them a history of the ACS Lord Davenport Lines side.
Okay.
So, then it came to people being accused, and they were saying, no, I didn't. Or, I don't have this game. Maybe I've got an open Wi-Fi, maybe it's that. And they rely on a German ruling that says, in Germany, it is your requirement to secure your Wi-Fi. If you have an open Wi-Fi, you're liable. And they'd send in the letters. Well, a German court has ruled that it is your issue if somebody uses your open Wi-Fi. And we feel that a UK court would react similarly. Give us £500. And it went on. There were other people who weren't at home, people who, 80-year-old grandmothers. They're not going to download a cheap pinball game. And said, we don't care. Our evidence says this. You're going to pay up. And then, around late 2008, there was a judgment finally went through. One case finally went to court. It was a woman called Barwiska. Is that right? Barwiska? I think that's how it's pronounced. It was a Polish name. I've no idea how to pronounce it easily, or if I'm doing it correctly, but she ended up getting a default judgment for £10,000, or about $16,000, because she did not contest it. And then in every subsequent letter Davenport Lions sent out, hey, we've got this default judgment here for £10,000. Do you want to be fined £10,000? No. Then pay us £500 now, and it'll all go away. And that's how these work. Now, it wasn't until, I think it was early last year or late 2010, that another law firm had been involved called ACS Law, and they were getting attacked by Anonymous. So it'd be late 2010. And their site went down. And their IT guy was restoring their site, and they put up a small IMAP folder with some of the emails. And Anonymous went, I'll have that, thank you. And then it included things like statements between the lawyer, Andrew Crossley, and others saying, well, I don't care what they say. You just hound them for more. If they get a letter, we put them into the reject pile. I think I might go and buy a new Ferrari. I like a Lamborghini. It's great to have all this money. And he'd been doing newspaper interviews saying, we're just doing this for the... we're just doing this for the artist, for the company that people are stealing from. And there was another email in there from their technical guy, Torrance Chang, I think it was, noting, we don't really have any kind of evidence. The evidence we have isn't that good. So, don't go to court. After this, the Solicitor Regulatory Authority, the SRA, got involved. He went to hearings. He was disbarred for several months, he's declared bankruptcy, he's lost his law firm. That's what happened in the UK, but only because he was forced to try a case. When he got to a judge, the judge said, no, you can't dismiss this, like he'd done with every other case. You can't just dismiss this. I want to see these cases. You've been saying in the newspapers, thing, we want to see these cases. These 17 people want to go to court. That's when it all fell apart for him. Now, in the US, it's slightly differently, as Leola attest. There's no Norwich Pharmacal orders. You've got to go through discovery. So why don't you talk us through how the US process works?
Well, I've been handling these cases for about...
Hang on. Can't hear me, can you? Can you? Okay.
So I've been handling these cases for about 2 years now, and basically the way they start is, did you explain already kind of the mass, you know, suit, a group of John Does and everything?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, basically they sue like thousands of people, and they send out these subpoenas asking, you know, for the information for the people, connected with their IP addresses, and they send out these settlement letters and everything. And really it varies on the jurisdiction, you know, what will happen with the case. Some courts have dismissed it, saying that it's improper, that, you know, they sue 24,000 people. For some reason, they find that that's, you know, a burden on the court in one lawsuit. So, and that's it's a legal issue called joinder. You know, there are certain criteria for joining, you know, large amounts of people together.
That they all have to be involved in the same crime together as a group that planned right. it. They can't just be in a similar crime at a similar time. So, like, right. not everybody who's been speeding at once can be joined into one speeding case and save the traffic courts a whole lot of time. Because I'm sure they'd like that. And say, okay, you're guilty, you must all be guilty. Give us all the fines.
Yeah, that's one of the issues that the judges really are starting to understand, and the ones that don't, or that allow the cases to go forward, I think they don't honestly understand how BitTorrent works. You know, because you're not necessarily connected to one another. You know, a person downloading in May is not necessarily connected to someone who downloads in, like, you know, August or something. So, you know, our job has been to, like, educate the judges on, like, the technology side of things, actually. So on a very basic level. But, you know, depending on the jurisdiction, that's how it comes out. You know, it'll be dismissed because of joinder. There's the issue of...
Jurisdiction.
Yes. You know, a court in D.C. doesn't have jurisdiction over people across the country. But for some reason, the plaintiff will argue that jurisdiction is proper, and then, you know, they'll get all the information, and then they'll dismiss everyone, and then the court will never get to address the issue. So that's how they circumvent it. It's sort of a dirty litigation tactic, basically. But, it, you know, ends up causing a lot of people stress, and, you know, a lot of people pay out settlements just to avoid the lawsuit. So that's why, you know, I have a problem with these lawsuits. You know, and you figure if they make, you know, if 10% of the people settle, you know, and you have 24,000 people in the lawsuit, and each person settles for an average of $2,000, you know, that's a big money-making scheme is basically what it amounts to.
What's the main film that you were dealing with? What was the main film?
Voltage Pictures. Well, it was a Voltage Pictures case. It's The Hurt Locker. So it's won an Academy Award, I believe, for, like, Best Picture. And but there are a lot. There are over 250,000 John Does sued, I think, as of sometime mid last year, and it's still going on. These cases are continuing to evolve. They're filing cases in state court now, alleging some sort of conspiracy. So if you use BitTorrent, you're, I guess, implicitly consenting to a conspiracy with other people.
And of course, we talked about Hurt. He mentioned Hurt Locker, and I mentioned Dream Pinball, 3D Dream Pinball to start with. They're not the only kind of titles that they do. They've kind of moved on, and there's another type of title that has become more common and more popular. Anybody got any idea what kind of thing it might be? Yes, sir. Pornography.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, often the more extreme, the better. Because who wants to be... Have we got any young ears, young minds? Anybody under 18? Anybody of a sensitive disposition? Anybody mind a little bit of cursing? One of the cases in the UK that really got the media, especially the Consumer Watchdog Association, enraged about it, was a title called Army Fuckers. There has been at least one bestiality film involved, and
One of them is called Teen Anal Nightmare 2. I didn't see the first one, but I heard it's good.
Hang on, can we, microphone? Ooh. So we can get this on the... Get this on...
I think it was in the movie Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels that the guy wanted to have the scheme where he sent out checks that had tied up the dildo
the
company.
Yeah. So, yeah. But that's their main system now, is because nobody wants to have their name on a plaintiff as a defendant with a plaintiff like, we're accusing you of downloading this extreme pornography. Because it's the public record.
There are a lot of reasons why people settle, you know, even, you know, people who didn't do it, they have security clearances, they don't want a lien or threat of litigation on their property, you know, they don't want their name associated with pornography, but their overall strategy is to basically overlook all that. They say they do not care. If you don't settle, then they'll just threaten a lawsuit against you. But you figure, you know, if they sue 250,000 people, or if they name 250,000 people, there's no possible way they're going to bring an individual suit against 250,000 people. So it's sort of, you know, a numbers game. You know, as a practical matter, they can't file all the lawsuits, so it's whether you want to pay the settlement to avoid that chance. Because they pick and choose, you know...
cases they think are soft targets.
Right, to make an example, basically, of people so they can include in their letters to future people. You know, look at this person, what example we made out of them. And so, you know, it doesn't create a good name for lawyers, and it's just a dirty strategy, basically.
Yeah, and one of the things is when they file the initial lawsuit, it's a, they get their expert who provides the peer-to-peer monitoring system, and their evidence, we went over it a few months back, and I think I found in just one testimony, which is, what, 7 pages long?
Yeah, around there.
I found 14 factual errors in the sworn testimony of their expert. And this was the one that was used all the time to grant the discovery, the ex parte discovery that gave them your names and addresses.
Right.
Or at least told the ISP to give them your names and addresses. There was a...
I actually just got done with a court case related to Occupy, and one of my things was when we had the chief of police go up, it was very obvious that from my memory, it was a little bit different from his memory. And in terms of factual errors in these kinds of cases, because all of our evidence was all YouTube and all sorts of digital media, how much factual evidence is it, I guess it's more for the lawyer, perjury if they have no idea what they're talking about?
Well, how much, you know, they're not, I guess to answer your question, they don't really get held accountable all that much because they dismiss the people before they don't continue on the lawsuit. Their goal is to get the information to send out these settlement letters. So unfortunately, we haven't been able to hold them accountable because you have one right to dismiss a lawsuit before the other party answers, and the court doesn't have any discretion to deny you that right. Once a person answers, then you have to get the judge's approval, and there's several factors they consider. But that's how they avoid all those issues of jurisdiction, joinder, you know, just by getting the information, you know, doing the discovery and getting the information. And they're not held accountable, really. And very few of these cases have gone to trial. And so I haven't had a chance to cross-examine these expert witnesses, so-called expert witnesses. You know, Andrew says that there's 7 errors, or I don't know how many.
15
errors we marked down in just one, you know.
Seven-page testimony.
Seven-page testimony. That's 2 per page. That's pretty bad. but, yeah, so.
Well, there's a gentleman at the back, right at the back.
Thank you.
Did they answer?
I just had something briefly to add regarding adult content. I work for an adult content producer in the Netherlands. So actually, you really will applaud me here in just a bit. But
so
no,
we both actually work for Dutch-based companies then, because Torrent Freaks is also a Dutch.
Okay.
Company.
Yeah, well, I'm based just outside of Amsterdam, but we largely cater to the UK, and I am our liaison to a group of UK adult producers. We were there for a presentation. I won't say given by whom. I'm not going to throw people under the bus. That could get me in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, they made it very, very clear in very plain words that they are looking for low-hanging fruit.
Yep.
When it comes to this, they are doing their research. It may be the only place they're actually doing their research, but they are doing their research to ensure that they are getting the softest targets, as you mentioned. This is not just being speculated on. It's said behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen it. I was there for it. But I would like to say just very quickly that on behalf of the company that I worked for, which is called Your Choice, we opted out of this. We didn't find it ethical. We didn't find it particularly profitable in the end. And
the lawyers take all the money.
Exactly. So we decided, if you can sleep at night, go for it. If not, we're out. So, but it is really being said that way.
Yep. It's all about just getting the turnover, getting the money in. It's not about what's right, it's not what's proper, what's good for everybody. It's just what makes the money.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes?
In this country, we have some judges who are elected, and so a group of lawyers, trial lawyers, might be able to choose their own judge. What are the risks that a court somewhere would reduce the fees so much that the obstacle you talked about, where you can't sue each individual, would disappear, and they could automate, 100,000 different lawsuits?
The main bar, I think, is the filing fee. So the filing fee is 300, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but
325 or 375,
something like that. If they were to lower that fee, it would definitely, kind of open the floodgates. But that's the main, they don't want to spend $300 to after people. They'd rather just send out a letter and try to harass a settlement.
Because if you're spending $350 to maybe get $500 back, and you're only getting a 10% rate, you're only getting basically $50 per.
Can they sue in a state court and buy off the state court to make the fee $1?
They tried Florida with a specific state copyright law last year. I think it was turned down. Sorry, I'm starting to get the con crud, so excuse me. But they tried that, and a judge turned them down. Now, there are sympathetic judges to them. Trying to think of a name. Judge Beryl Howell, I think it is.
Former IAA lobbyist.
Yes, she lobbied for... Which law was it, though?
RIAA.
I think she actually lobbied for the Copyright Term Extension Act in 1998.
Yeah.
But she is now a judge in... Is it D.C.?
Yep, D.C.
She's a District of Columbia federal judge, and there was a ruling... two weeks ago, one of the things we talked about is jurisdiction, and they had a thing called geolocation. Everybody know what geolocation is? Pretty much everyone? Okay. She refused to allow a geolocation service because it was only 95% accurate. So there's only a 95% chance that the people who would find in her district would actually be, would be in her district. That wasn't good enough for her, so she decided that everybody was still subject to it in her jurisdiction because there was no accurate enough way for her to determine that they were in her district or not. How crazy is that? She's bucked every other judge's rulings. When we say, some are for it, she is the main one.
That's why they file the lawsuits in D.C., because a lot of the judges are favorable. That's one of the problems is they could forum. It's called forum shopping, so they can just try and pick the jurisdiction that they think is going to give them the best rulings. And there have been situations where they'll file in one jurisdiction, the court will smack them down, and then they'll refile in another jurisdiction, and that one doesn't work, they'll refile in another jurisdiction. So,
and of course, this forum shopping, while I'm moving the micro, is also very common in patents. And the Eastern District of Texas is notorious for being the home of patent litigation for that same reason.
So what is the cost of, let's assume you're a user and you choose litigation. Like, you know, do you have any numbers for average, you know, average length of settlement, or how much it costs, or where to go, or what companies to use, or anything?
Well, there are a few attorneys. I'm one of the few attorneys in Georgia that has been handling these cases. But there are a lot of copyright attorneys, but attorneys that handle specifically BitTorrent-related cases. I've kind of created a niche in that area. And my name's on the Electronic Frontier Foundation website, and we've kind of established a network of people who can, you know, we share information and strategies and stuff like that.
Not just in Georgia, but other and related states like Florida. I've spoken to a lawyer or two in Florida, Graham.
But the thing is, a part of their strategy is that the amount they're going to try and get a settlement from you is slightly less actually than it would cost to retain an attorney. And so that's, they know that. And so they price their settlement offers in that range. So it's all very structured and planned, the amounts, the letters and everything. But if you win your case, then you have a chance of getting your attorney's fees back. But the thing is, you have to go through the case and go through the stress. And some people who, you know, are innocent, so to speak, they just don't want to go through it, and they end up paying the settlement. And so, but I usually recommend, you know, don't settle. And there's other things you could do.
And of peer-to-peer cases, there's been four that I'm aware of that have gone all the way through. There's Baker, Foster, Thomas, and Tenenbaum. Tenenbaum is still at the district court level, and that case started in 2004.
It's been going on for.
Thomas. Again, started 2004, then out the appeals court. Baker and Foster, they were dismissed. Foster, I think it was awarded, only awarded, it was the judge cut it down, $200,000 in attorney fees to defend herself, and that was only to go through to the district court. So that's the kind of cost you're looking at. You've got to find a lawyer who will work with you with the costs. And
the average... I would say the average retainer to start for a case in federal court is probably $5,000. So, you know, if they make a $2,500 offer or $2,000 offer, the attorney can get it down to $1,500 sometimes or $1,000. Then, you know, it's hard not to settle when you're faced with that prospect of litigation. You know, but I've had clients who want to litigate it, and those are my favorite clients because. We can fight them, but...
You don't get precedent until you fight it. You don't solve the problem still, I think.
My question is about copy shops and other sort of public places that provide semi-open Wi-Fi. Have you defended those types of businesses in court, or does that come up?
I haven't defended a coffee shop, but I've defended a dry cleaners that just had a wireless network, and someone hacked into it and was using it for, you know... whatever they're doing. I think this one was stealing the passwords or something.
And even then, unlike Germany, you know, Germany's the only one I'm aware of where you have to secure your Wi-Fi, otherwise you're liable and you're negligent.
Right, so the way copyright law is that you can't be liable just because someone uses, like, something you own to infringe. You have to, like, either know of it or consent to it or participate or help them do it or something like that. Basically, to make you secondarily liable. But, you know, Germany, I guess, is different.
Germany's the one exception.
But they'll come out and they'll say, you know, it's your responsibility, you're liable, but I've found no basis in the law for that. I've done my research on that.
Now, when you mentioned that, is that limited to the entirety of the United States, or is there going to be state and city exemptions to that clause?
That is across the country. Like, no court in my I haven't found a single court that said simply because you own an internet connection, you're liable for whatever someone does on it, even if there's someone, like, basically trespassing on your system.
And as we talked about in the CISPA-SOPA panel yesterday, the copyright law was rewritten in 76, wasn't it? And before that, there was a hodgepodge of state laws.
It was copyright, and then it has been amended since the 1900s or something.
Yeah, but until like 76, and with one universal federal one, it was all, each state had separate copyright laws. Tennessee has a stricter copyright law than most because of Nashville and, you know, the country music scene. So it used to be state laws, but now they've mostly been preempted now by the federal law.
Right. So that's why it's so bizarre that they're coming out with these new theory, the conspiracy, trespass to two chattels, which is another fancy name for like a tangible object. And all these new theories, like they're trying to avoid even having to send out these letters and give notice to people to try and challenge these lawsuits. So Illinois is really bad. I don't know. I've heard bad things about the Illinois courts, and so far they made some terrible rulings on that. So just letting them go, the subscribers don't have any idea that their information is being subpoenaed. They don't have a chance to object to it or anything. That's even worse than the cases filed in federal court, where at least you get a notice and a chance to try and challenge it, even though you know a D.C. court is going to deny your motion. But you don't get any notice whatsoever.
The companies that are filing these lawsuits, are they allowed to pursue their legal costs also? So can they send you a letter that says, give us $1,000, and oh, by the way, if we have to send you another letter, it's $2,000. Are they able to pursue that?
In the UK, that's what Davenport used to do. They used to actually have, not round figures, they'd actually sometimes use, if you ever read like the Jack Ryan books from Tom Clancy, he had they called it the Canary Trap, you know, slight differences. And they'd actually, has anybody here ever seen Slick.com? Slick.com is a news website. It's Thomas Manneke in New York runs it. It's not as big as it once was, but it had a very strong forum when the UK cases were going and were actually subpoenaed by the UK courts at one point to deal with it. But they had, I think it was a 150-page thread just on the Davenport Lions cases, and people would post their letters. But then Davenport were watching it as well, and they knew the individual amount. So even if you hid your name, the individual amount would be different for each person, or enough that they could narrow it down to two or three people and say, no, you were getting advice from people and what worked and what didn't, so that you were therefore a harder target and therefore not the low-hanging fruit they want to spend the time and the money on. So, you know, it's...
How do the courts justify damages of, you know, tens of thousands of dollars when whatever you downloaded was, you know, you could have gotten on iTunes for $1 or, you know, $10 for a movie or something like that?
We're talking about Tenenbaum and Thomas here, I'm guessing?
Just anything. How can they say, you know, you owe us $1 million because you downloaded a movie when that movie could have been bought for $20?
Well, there are two ways you get damages in a copyright suit. One is actual damage, and the plaintiff gets to choose which, I guess, methodology they want. First is actual damages, and they have to come and show lost sales and stuff like that. But, you know, if you have one download, that's not very attractive. You know, you're not going to sue for $20. So the other method is statutory damages, and that's a range from $750 to $30,000. And then and the court considers a variety of factors, you know, whether it was willful, whether they made money off it, or whether it was just for personal use and stuff like that. But, you know, if each song can be an infringement. So that's why you get cases, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars. It's just an absurd amount. You know, no one can pay. You know, it'd be bankruptcy and paying for the rest of your life. So,
well, and that's the other thing. When it comes to a physical thing, like one CD, it's got 12 tracks in it. You steal it, that's one item worth $20. You download that, it's 12 tracks. That's 12 infringements, each one with a minimum of 250 non-willful. 250 non-willful, right, yeah. 750 willful. So, you know, in most states, the petty theft shoplifting has a maximum penalty of 1,000, thereabouts. Sure. Yeah. You know, 1,000 is the most of the criminal penalty for shoplifting that CD, but you're looking at 7,500 for a 10-track CD minimum statutory damages for downloading it. And you haven't taken anything.
I know no one out here has a lot of MP3s, but just imagine, you can do the math. So, I think you had a question.
I just wanted to clarify, so that was S-L-Y-C-K for Slick?
S-L-Y-C-K, yes. Slick.
That's the one I thought. Thank you.
First off, I just want to say I'm pretty sure that when New Zealand passed their whole copyright thing, I believe you're responsible for anything that happens on your Wi-Fi was part of that.
The Section 92A?
I'm not sure what section. I haven't kept close watch recently, but I think as part of the whole package, all that crazy stuff. But I guess more what I wanted to ask more specifically is I know pretty much everything they go after takes place in the civil courts, because from what I've understood, criminally, it's next to impossible for them to criminally prosecute a case. And even beyond that, the criminal statute for copyright infringement, it's like your typical user who's downloading a movie here and there, maybe an album, is very rarely going to cross the threshold into like actual criminal copyright infringement. I've keep up with this stuff a bit, but I haven't actually ever had a chance to like speak to a lawyer. I just thought I would put that up there.
Yeah, they don't very rarely do they prosecute people for copyright, you know, for downloading a single album.
Yeah, but how many here have heard of the copyright downloading is stealing? Seen the movie thing? How many? Hands up, roughly.
Wow.
Half. Is it? Yes or no?
No, it's copying.
Right. It is not the same. They want it to be considered theft in the minds of the legislatures, in the minds of the judges, in the minds of the people, so they don't do it. The one place they don't want it to be considered theft is in the courtroom. As I've said just now, the damages are incredibly, you know, the penalties are significantly reduced for a criminal case. What's the difference in evidence and burden of proof?
Well, beyond a reasonable doubt in criminal, and then in civil, it's preponderance of the evidence, which you could think of as like 50% plus one. So more likely than not is basically what that standard is. And beyond a reasonable doubt, scholars have tried to set as probably around 95% or something like that. You know.
So they've got reduced damages, increased burden of evidence, and you get a lawyer assigned to you. You don't have to go out and pay for it. You can get a public defender for a criminal case.
Right.
So why would they want it to be considered as theft? You know, they don't want it considered theft, they just want it to associate it with your mind. So that's another mind game, another word game that they try and play to mess around with you.
This may depend on the state, but there's some different opinions on whether you should answer the letters or not, because that helps them perfect service. And a lot of advice is don't answer the letter because that perfects service. You know, Marshall's not bringing it out to you. I just wondered your opinion on that. And also, can you just talk about prevention a little bit and some practical things to do to keep it from getting to that point, whether it's VPNs or answering the letter or not, or other things to stay out of the final list of people they want to go after?
So what was the first part of your question?
Answer the letter.
About the answer the letter. The letter itself isn't, they're not trying to serve you with that letter. They have to file the lawsuit in your home state because jurisdiction is not going to be proper in like District of Columbia. And then they'll serve you with the complaint, and then they'll have to, usually they'll mail it, and then they'll include a form that if you consent to it, then you can respond, you have extra time to respond, and then you consent to mail, service via mail. But usually they'll have to have the sheriff come out if they don't do it that way.
So the letter or no?
Basically, my personal advice is, if you know you didn't do it, say, I'll write a letter back saying, no, I did not do this. I do not believe your evidence is correct. And send that to them. Then they've got it, and you can keep a copy so you can say to the court, look, we told them we didn't do it months ago. And it may help your case a bit more with a sympathetic judge that, you know, you said up the front that you didn't do it. And he may, be more sympathetic that they're wasting the court's time.
Right, and that makes it sort of sets it up, so if it goes to trial and they lose, then you can talk to the judge and say, look, we sent them all this information, affidavits. I do affidavits sometimes for clients or other legal memoranda. Just say, look, we did this, 6 months before they brought the suit in Georgia or home state or wherever, and the court's, going to award attorney's fees more likely. So, I would talk to an attorney if you get one of these letters. You know, some people ignore them, and then they come back after their lawsuit's filed against them, and that's not good. So,
Don't ignore it. Don't bury it under the bed, because
And don't call them and try and talk to their attorneys.
No, like we said, we're dealing with the cops last night. They're not gonna remember. They're gonna have selective amnesia. They're gonna forget anything that helps you. They're only gonna remember what can incriminate you, what they can use against you. Their job's not to, sort it out. They're not the judge. They're an attorney, and their job is to prosecute you and to get as much from you as they can. So if they have to remember every other word to do so, basically, pretty much.
Yeah, just they're there to gather evidence. That's what they're doing. They're there to interrogate and get as much out of you as possible, whether you did it. And maybe you've done other stuff. You know, they can leverage against you or whatever.
And the second part was about what can be done to defend. All right. Yeah, prevent. Yes, sorry. It's been a long convention already. You've got VPNs. They work as long as they don't keep logs. Now, one of the downsides of the VPN is most of the time you've got to pay for it. If you pay for it, then you've still got an audit trail. Sure, as long as you've got logs, they can track who you are and they can track you through your payments. It's a long process. It's very rarely done. There's only the hide my ass one with the, was it the LulzSec guy who got, you know, hide my ass, turned over his information, his IP address, and he used a VPN and they still got him.
Different VPNs have different policies.
Yeah, they all have different policies, and some don't always stick to their own policy as well. And while it can slow things down significantly if your VPN is in a different country, because then you've got all the different jurisdictional.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's another thing called a block list. Anybody heard of a block list? Anybody use a block list? Do you use one by BlueTAC or BIS? BISS, BlueTAC Information Systems? Or do you use the default one that comes with Peer Block, Peer Guardian, Safe Peer? Congratulations, you've made yourselves the low-hanging fruit. There is zero evidence that they work. And there was a famous study by the University of Washington in 2008. Anybody ever hear about the printers at the University of Washington that got DMCA notices for sharing movies?
A printer in got the notice.
In 2008, the University of Washington was running a study on BitTorrent protocols. And they were spoofing IP addresses to a BitTorrent tracker. They started getting DMCA notices addressed to these IP addresses. These IP addresses belong to Wi-Fi routers, network printers. They were being accused of sharing films on printers across the internet. Not, you know, printing it out, but, you know, distributing it, BitTorrenting it. They repeated the study about 6 months later, and they used the BlueTAC block list. The hit rate, you know, the number of letters they got for the number of torrents they ran, pretty much doubled. You see, the people who you're trying to block, they can get the lists as well as anybody else can. I'm on that list. What am I going to do? Here's my modem. Unplug. Wait 30 seconds. Plug it back in. I've got a new IP address. Am I on that list anymore? Oh, I am. Okay, I'll unplug it again. I'll get a new IP address. There is nothing saying that they have to use a corporate IP. There is nothing saying they can't use, you know, a Wi-Fi at a thing. They just have to get on a torrent, a monitor. They can be any peer they want. There's no way to identify, there's no way to tell if a peer on there is monitoring you for a company. And that's why these block lists don't work. The other thing is, who runs BlueTAC Information, the standard company for this? Anybody know? Because I sure don't, and I've been trying to find out for the last 3 years. I've managed to track them so far to a virtual office shared with a law firm in Bournemouth, England. That's as far as I've managed to get them in 3 years. The guy who made Peer Guardian doesn't know. They won't tell him either. So, you know, you got to wonder, is it somebody actually trying to help? Or is it actually someone like the Business Software Association running it as a front? To block legitimate peers and send you all to the ones they're on and monitoring. The final one is like a proxy system. Don't use Tor. Whatever you do, do not use Tor. The Tor people will kill you because you're using up all their bandwidth. Tor is not for peer-to-peer use, and it won't work very well for you anyway. So, you know, that's the main thing. The other thing is a seed box. Anybody use seed boxes? That's when you go to a co-location center, a data center, and you rent a server. And it's, you know, it's on a high-speed link, it's got a hard drive, and you just run a BitTorrent client on it. and you use it as a remote computer to BitTorrent. And when you're done, you just FTP it back to your own site. So it's not your IP address they're monitoring. But, like a VPN, you've got payment details. So that they just have to go and request the payment details, and then they'll have the added incentive, you know, you did this and you paid for it, therefore you must know it was wrong.
Right. That goes to the willful part of the, you know.
You must have known you're infringing, otherwise you wouldn't have gone to all these details, and you can't say somebody else did it because you got the name on your thing and you paid for it. Right. What else are you using it for?
About block lists and BlueTac, I use iBlockList, is that?
Yep, that's okay. that's one guy who runs it, and he basically collates the BlueTac list and adds one or two others of his thing, but they all on the same principle that they can spot people who are monitoring, and they can't.
Okay, so do they? It doesn't necessarily hurt to use a block list; it just doesn't necessarily help. Is that what you're saying?
Well, if you've got a block list, I think the BlueTac list, when I checked, Slick again did a study. There's been one release, and exactly one release, to my knowledge, of IPs used for anti peer-to-peer work, and that was Media Defender in 2008. I want to say 2008, 2010. They had a similar email breach. A month later, Slick went and ran a check of a section of the list against the whole BlueTac list. The BlueTac list blocked 30% of all IP addresses at the time. Anybody want to have a guess of what the hit rate was? How many of the IP addresses that Defender was using that was actually on the block list? No, not 30%. Try 3%. If they'd have populated the list at random, they'd have had a statistically much better chance of working. And it only takes one IP address, one monitor, to start a lawsuit.
Yep.
I had one more question about wiretapping. You mentioned earlier about it's like 1% or 0.1% or however much of BitTorrent traffic gets monitored. How hard is it for law enforcement to get a wiretapping? That's not my question.
As far as anyone
in general who wants to do the wiretapping, how hard is it for them? Like, be it either from the content producers themselves or the ISP or law enforcement?
Well, I don't think it would constitute wiretapping.
The ISPs would be wiretapping you just to listen in to find you doing BitTorrent, is what I was saying earlier.
Okay.
But we did a whole panel, was it yesterday or maybe Friday, on wiretapping and what was involved in it. And like all our panels, that'll be on later. But as for the content producers themselves, they own the copyright. They can just jump on it and act like a peer and just monitor who's on it and what they do.
Because the protocol will randomly assign connected to various peers. They just, you know, compile a list of who all they're connected to.
And all the software they need, and I did a video of it and I can show it to you later, is uTorrent. You can use the standard plain uTorrent, microtorrent, muTorrent, call it what you will. Go to the logger tab, turn on, you right click, and then you turn on the logging thing, and you have it automatically save, and then you just run a torrent. And it'll save all the IP addresses, all the activity of the peers you're connecting to, and it'll save it to a text file. And then you can just dump that out later. And there's your monitoring done.
And then you file a lawsuit on that.
Yep, on those IPs. That's all you need to do to monitor a swarm. It doesn't act any differently than anyone else, because all you're doing is monitoring the actions of a regular peer.
About that, isn't that like entrapment to a certain extent? If you're hosting the content.
Well, if you're hosting it, you could argue that you're basically facilitating the infringement, so you're implicitly
licensing the distribution.
Copy.
Yeah, but yeah. Entrapment's only available for law enforcement, and only if they make
it more likely that you would to commit the crime.
Induce you to commit, yeah.
Right.
They're not hosting it, as the gentleman said, they're not hosting it. They're just monitoring it, and they can get the bits, and often they'll send out garbage bits that you'll delete, and with BitTorrent, when you get junk data from a peer after so many times, you'll ban that peer. And that's great for the people who are monitoring, because then they can just, you've disconnected them, and they can just pull a new peer, and they can go through the whole swarm really quickly by just sending out junk data.
And in all honesty, we haven't even gotten that far to cross-examine their experts to see whether they're uploading data as well, because then that's a legal argument, is if they're uploading data, they're participating in the swarm and thereby consenting to the infringement. So it destroys their entire case. Andrew might know more about that, is if it's possible to be a peer and not upload information. That would be an important thing to know.
There was a case, I think it was last year, where somebody did file about him distributing, and I think it was in Canada, but he was using a hacked client which did not upload. And when he proved that in court, the case was just dismissed. But to date, there has not been any evaluation of the validity or the technology used to monitor and used as evidence in these cases.
Yeah. Well, you kind of touched on this, or what I'm about to ask. Not traditional peer-to-peer, but what about Usenet news groups? How does that play into the whole?
Well, because that's a client-server model, where you're just downloading off a website, then it's a lot like the rapid share and the mega upload systems, where they can't get a man in the middle, they can't, you know, monitor what you're doing easily. But as in all cases, it's never downloading that they go after, it's uploading. So the few cases have been always about the uploading. So with Thomas, it was about having 24 songs available. With Tenenbaum, it was 30 songs making available. It was never about the downloading. So as long, you know, but then again, you get things like Andrew Cuomo. He's the New York governor at the moment. When he was the attorney general, he convinced AT&T to shut down all their Usenet servers. I'm an AT&T subscriber myself, but I don't have Usenet access anymore through my ISP because he convinced them to shut down because of child porn. And everybody's got to be against, you know, everybody's against child porn. That was, again, something we talked about with the Sopa Pippa panel yesterday, that, you know, terrorism, child porn, what were the other two?
Yeah, I can't remember the other one. Three pretexts or examples they give to support any sort of legislation and stuff like that. And they always say, child porn, pass it. And then it's written so broadly, it covers everything, you know, so...
You mentioned countries. Going through different countries can make it a lot harder for them. What are some countries that have really good privacy laws and stuff like that will really be a pain in their ass?
Well, it's not really so much privacy laws. And I heard somebody just say Sweden, but then again, they have the FRA law that was passed in 2009 where their government actually monitors every bit of data traffic that goes through their system. So, and they also have the... I want to say IPRED law that was passed, I believe it went into force middle of 2009, where it was basically a lot like Sopa Pippa in many ways. There's never been any enforcement of it yet, the same with Hadopi in France, but it's there and it exists. So as for which countries, it depends. They've copyright trolls, which is, you know, the name we give to the law firms not to do this. They've operated in Germany, England and Wales, rather, because Scotland has a different law system somewhat, and now here. But who knows where the next one's going to pop up. But any country can be the target of litigation. Demonoid was recently shut down. Any Demonoid users here? Well... You know, they were apparently hosted in the Ukraine, and there are reports that there were arrests to do with it in Mexico. We don't know the validity of it, but that's, you know, international happens. Frederick, one of the Pirate Bay guys is based in, he lives in Laos.
They're still looking for one of them, aren't they?
Yeah, he's in Laos. I haven't had any index since Wednesday because I've been here, but it was Sunday. Was it Brokep, Tiamo, Anakata? Frederick Gottfried?
Yeah, and
oh, he had problems with his passport. The Swedish government revoked his passport like a week ago. His wife was giving birth in Cambodia, but he lived in Laos. And that's where he's been for like the last 2-3 years. Which is, I think the last time I spoke to him was about a year ago. Because... Hang on, no, let's get it on.
In the article that I'd read, there wasn't a lot of specifics as to why he was arrested. And I read it on Reddit like yesterday or the day before. So, I don't know. I just wanted to bring it up. I thought it'd be weird to not bring it up since we're talking about law.
Wait, yeah, that's... again, that goes back to what I said at the start, that with the Pirate Bay, it was the four people behind the site, the coder, the press guy, the financier, and the guy who wrote the tracker that got targeted, but not the site itself. Mainly because I didn't want a lot of people now to vote for the Pirate Party again.
I was at the SOPA panel yesterday, and the four justifications were child porn, kidnapping, money laundering, and terrorism.
There we go. Thank you.
Just so you know, child porn is bad.
Yeah, we don't condone that at all. I got three kids myself.
Just as a question, and I know it's totally hypothetical, what are we looking in terms of time frame for actually setting legal precedent?
The plaintiffs don't want a legal precedent to be set on some issues because they don't want like the issue of jurisdiction, because once that precedent is set, then they can't just file these lawsuits. You know, you could cite cases saying, you know, jurisdiction's improper. But there's precedent slowly building, I guess. You know, but it depends on the jurisdiction. Like courts in Texas have dismissed them. Arizona's been really good. I mean, in Arizona, you can actually report to like the attorney general now, and you know, basically accuse them of violating the law by harvesting your IP address, because there's a law that pertains to private investigators. And you could argue that an IP address is like a location, you know,
personal information.
And so the attorney general's come out and said, come to my office and report this type of stuff. So that killed the lawsuits right there.
Michigan's been the same, that they've you know, questioned about the legality of it regards to being a private investigator.
Right. So I guess my follow-up question for that is, theoretically, if I wanted to take this on, I got the nice little letter from my ISP, but I was in college and I was in a dorm.
Is this theoretically or?
Well, I had one of those. That was a while ago.
Okay.
I just ignored it. But theoretically, if I wanted to fight this and make myself so-called like a target, so we could go farther and farther and farther and actually set precedent,
no.
Is that possible?
No, absolutely not.
They have to allow it.
It's a joint decision, is it?
But
I mean, it's possible. You know, we could do that. And I have some clients who are interested in just fighting for out of principle, and those are my favorite clients. So,
but the problem is, they don't want to pursue the case because you're not the low hanging fruit.
Right.
You're right at the top of the tree.
And
you're so much effort to get the money that unless they got an airtight case, which they don't, probably we don't know. We can't tell what their evidence collection process is. But until then, we can't fight it. You can't be fought because they don't want to fight it. They don't want to have the risk of losing. So,
and then they'll try and dismiss it, and then it's up to the judge whether it can be dismissed. And you have to try to argue, you know, that it shouldn't be dismissed, or if it is dismissed, you should get attorney's fees. And judges will come down different sides on that as well. So,
and you said about time frame. This isn't a new problem. There's an attorney called Ray Beckerman. And he runs a blog called The Recording Industry Versus the People, where he tracks all these cases and posts the documents. And in 2008, he wrote a piece for the journal that all the judges get, which lays out all the issues with copyright trolls. Every judge got it over their summer break in 2008. I think it was 2008. Mm-hmm. Might have been 2007. But he laid out all the problems with Joinder and how mass people get it. The evidence, the inducement, and yet, you know, this is 2012, and you still got Judge Beryl Howell saying, yes, Joinder's great, it's proper, it's appropriate. So that's 5 years, and they haven't even got past the basic law arguments that we all know. And as I said, the Tenenbaum and Thomas cases have been going on since 2004, and they're barely at the appeal stage.
Yep.
So it's a long, long process.
I think you had a question over here first.
I think we're on to the last two or three questions. We're just about running out of time as well.
Yeah, so you've talked about the technical things you can do to protect yourself from an unfair law and the judicial tactics you can use to protect yourself from an unfair law. Is there anything that we can do to change the legislative, you know, approach to, you know, taking copyright from 17 years to forever?
Right, or, you know, your representative. Tell him. Go to his office. Write a handwritten letter. This is a game we covered it on the Sopa Pippa panel yesterday. You know, sign a petition doesn't work because they count like 10,000 petitions, signatures, as one complaint. Write a letter. The more effort you put into it, the more power they give, the more weight they give to it. So you go up to their office. That's a lot of, you know, a lot of weight behind it. You handwrite a letter, that's more. You send an email, that's a phone call's in between, the faxes, you know. Let them know. And, you know, also support organizations like the EFF, ACLU, EPIC, and heck, as a former pirate party head and the thing, join and support your local pirate party as well. Why not? Give democracy a chance. Download, read, or buy No Safe Harbor. And No Safe Harbor 2 will be coming out by the December 1st is the due date, but it depends how quickly I get it edited and typeset and everything else.
All right, this is jumping back a bit, but okay. You mentioned there was a judge who was a lobbyist for the RIAA.
Judge Beryl Howell.
All right, how are they allowed...
So glad you mentioned her name.
Yeah. How are they allowed to handle these cases? Because they're obviously biased.
I think it was 2 years since she stopped being a lobbyist, and so I think she technically is not violating like the judicial code of conduct. But, you know...
But can't the argument be made... Well, she didn't. Hey, you shouldn't try this case. Someone else should.
She didn't work for the company that is filing the lawsuit, though. Just because she worked for a similar company and pressed issues similar to it, doesn't count as a conflict of interest.
Let's say if she was called to be a member of a jury, you would be able to throw her out of the jury if they're trying a copyright case.
If you used a peer-to-peer program in your life and you were called to a jury in a copyright case, they'd throw you out as a jurist. So, and if you had it, it's a lot, you know, they're a lot more stringent on as a jurist.
And a judge could recuse, she could recuse herself, but she chooses not.
Yeah.
All right, so maybe the question I should be asking is who looks at the judges then to say, you should be looking at this case, you shouldn't be looking at this case?
Well, nobody. No. Really?
Okay.
That happened in Sweden with the Pirate Bay case. The judges that tried the initial case were members of a pro-copyright judicial association, and they'd spoken. There was a case recently where... Oh, the Mega Upload trial, Kim.com. A judge actually called the U.S. DOJ actions, you know, the great Satan. He immediately recused himself from the rest of the case. Doesn't happen the other way around. If, you know, people who are, you know, oh, he's an expert on the copyright law, you know, he's a member of this pro-copyright association. That just means he knows a lot about copyright law. You know, he's therefore an expert and therefore actually an ideal person to try this case because he knows a lot about it because he's part of all these associations. Yeah.
So, any more questions?
I think maybe slip in one more before we have to call time.
Has anyone here received a letter?
Yes, we had
Did
about...
Did we already go over that?
Yeah, we had about a couple of dozen people who had notices. Not an actual letter or a lawsuit, though.
Okay, that's good.
But, okay then, thank you. The audio for this panel will be on the EFF Track website by the end of the month, so Anything you've forgotten, didn't hear, missed? I talk too much, I talk too quick, you don't understand my accent. You can listen to it at your leisure, at length, and in great detail. Thank you.